This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 2008 financial crisis led to legislation known as Dodd-Frank. 8 years later, President Trump says the reform of how financial institutions are regulated is limiting economic growth. We're going to discuss what major changes to Dodd-Frank could mean with Western Michigan University political science professor Kevin Corder. His research areas include economic policy. He's also the author of two books on the Federal Reserve System. Kevin Corder, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
Let's first of all go back and explain when Dodd-Frank was passed. What were lawmakers and the Obama administration at that time trying to do in reaction to the financial crisis?
Well, there were a couple of things packaged up in Dodd-Frank. One was consumer protection, to make sure that consumers were informed about the loan products that they were getting and the risk that those loans brought to the consumer. A second was the problem of so-called systemic risk, how the failure of one financial institution can lead to the failure of others, and they created the Financial Stability Oversight Council. And the third one is safety and soundness of individual banks, where they looked at capital requirements and put in restrictions on trading, like the Volcker Rule, to make sure that individual banks were safe. So the Dodd-Frank response to the crisis served those three big objectives.
As we sit here now in 2017, the economy has improved. We have not had another financial crisis. Admittedly, that's a kind of simplistic way to look at this, but could you then argue that, yes, Dodd-Frank has succeeded?
Well, most of the analysts say that by two measures, Dodd-Frank has been successful. One is that banks are they're better capitalized, so they're better able to withstand a financial shock. And the other is that lending has returned to pre-crisis levels. So under that framework, banks have been able to extend credit to borrowers.
And yet at the same time, we do hear some business interests saying that Dodd-Frank is too burdensome. What are their complaints about the law?
Well, the number one complaint is compliance costs. There's so many new rules in Dodd-Frank that banks have had to hire cores of compliance professionals in order to make sure that they're actually satisfying the new rules. So that's been a big administrative cost that's been added to banks. The second is the capital requirements. The banks are required to hold more and more capital. So that means that the volume of lending that they can do it at the same level of capital is lower, so it cuts into their profits. So the argument is that banks could be more profitable because they could lower costs and hold less capital.
William D. Cohen, writing in Vanity Fair, kind of makes this point. According to Davis Polk, the Wall Street law firm, the new regulations governing the banking system run to more than 22,000 pages of new rules on top of the 848 pages of the Dodd-Frank law, all of which is still in the process of being decoded, let alone understood. Is that kind of making the case there that if Dodd-Frank should still be in existence, maybe it needs to be simplified or some of the requirements need to be brought back?
Yeah, well, there are 500 rulemaking charges to the federal banking regulators inside of Dodd-Frank. So the statute itself doesn't tell the regulators exactly what to do. The regulators come up with rules after they get the statutory permission to engage in this kind of new regulation. And that has been ongoing. It's not finished. They're still refining some of those rules, still implementing those rules. Yeah, it's very, very complex. And there are some particular rules that the regulators have implemented in ways that Congress is not satisfied with, and we could expect to see some changes there. So that is not an inaccurate characterization of 22,000 pages of new rules as a consequence of that statute.
When you hear complaints about Dodd-Frank, are there some things that kind of get thrown into the mix that maybe don't really apply to the Dodd-Frank law? In other words, you know, complaints about the way the financial system is regulated that fall under that in the claims people make, but it's not accurate because people have used the term Dodd-Frank to mean a lot of different things now.
Right. So the number one kind of confusion there is the distinction between capital requirements, which are articulated in these international agreements called the Basel Accords. We're implementing Basel III and Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is has very limited language about capital requirements, only says that new capital requirements can't be easier than the capital requirements in place before the crisis. So capital requirements are bank regulations. Those are articulated and developed by the banking regulators together. But that is a result of an international convention where we make agreements with other countries, where we come to terms about how all banks globally are going to be regulated. That's very separate from Dodd-Frank. Reform of Dodd-Frank is not going to change implementation of Basel III.
Do the smaller banks have a legitimate claim that they didn't cause the financial crisis? It wasn't their practices, and yet they fall under a lot of these regulations. They still affect them, and in some ways, they may be even at a disadvantage compared to the larger banks. They can't hire as many employees to wade through this stuff.
Right. That's a fair criticism. Community banks that are small and have a local footprint do not pose a systemic risk to the financial system. They didn't fail in disproportionate numbers in the financial crisis, but yet they have to follow the same kind of consumer financial protection and other regulatory requirements as the bigger banks. And you're exactly right. Hiring compliance staff is expensive, and it means that big banks have a real advantage in their ability to absorb that kind of regulatory burden compared to small banks. So there's a lot of discussion, sensible discussion, that we need proportionality. We need to have less regulation, less scrutiny of smaller banks, more regulation, more scrutiny of the big, riskier banks.
Is there a way to do that artfully in legislation that gets at the problem and, gets at this in a surgical way that doesn't either A, prove to be too burdensome on the smaller banks, at the same time doesn't take us back to what we had back in 07, 08?
Yeah, well, the political reality is that the lobbying forces of the large banks are extremely powerful. So when you start to renegotiate the rules that the agencies have come up with to implement Dodd-Frank, the people who have the loudest voice and are the most vocal are the large banks and their lobbyists. So they tend to inform the discussion and they tend to tilt the rules in favor of the large banks. So you open the door for reform, the large bank lobbyists come through, and you end up with a playing field that still benefits large banks. So I'd be wary of this claim that they're going to be that anybody will be able to tailor legislation just to provide relief to community banks. That is what we need, and we'll see if that can happen.
One of the other phrases that people will remember from 2008 is too big to fail. Does Dodd-Frank get at that question at all?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions in the reform is what is going to happen with what's called orderly liquidation authority. And that is the Dodd-Frank solution to too big to fail. It just means that under Dodd-Frank, there's an FDIC authority to take over and wind down large, complex financial institutions, authority that did not exist prior to Dodd-Frank and did not exist in 2008. So Dodd-Frank was a specific response to the inability to wind down these large firms. And we haven't tested this yet because we haven't had a large firm that we needed to wind down. But if we go back to the status quo, circa 2008, it's letting those firms go through the bankruptcy process, which is slow and cumbersome and would be incredibly disruptive. So if you're going to deal with too big to fail in the context of dismantling Dodd-Frank, you got to reform the bankruptcy code so that large, complex financial institutions can be resolved in an orderly way.
Steve Eisman, it's a name that people may not know right away, but if they've seen The Big Short, he was the inspiration for the character played by Steve Carell. He has defended Dodd-Frank, but he has also said that he questions the idea of breaking up big banks, which was called for by, amongst others, Bernie Sanders during the 2016 campaign. He says that actually, if you start breaking up big banks, you could be choking off credit and having detrimental effects. But he also says part of the reason it's not necessarily a good idea is because of the positive reforms in Dodd-Frank. Does that show maybe some of the different branches and the interconnected components here of financial reform and how they may work together, but sometimes they may sort of work at cross purposes?
Well, the reality under Dodd-Frank's is that the big banks have gotten bigger. So they have not declined in size. So one of the prescriptions coming from a wide variety of left and right thinkers is that we need to just have caps on bank size to a certain proportion of GDP. Makes them easier to wind down, makes them less risky for the financial system as a whole. But that has not gotten any traction. The only kind of thing that moves in that direction is there is a capital requirement that's in addition, it's a supplemental capital requirement. So there's more capital required for the largest financial institutions to discourage them from growing. But in the 8 years since the financial crisis, the big banks have gotten bigger and the smaller banks have not thrived.
If you were to put some sort of cap in there, are you going to, have to put some time frames in there? I mean, because GDP changes, so
sure.
Percentage of GDP could be changing and a bank could be at a good place and then find that they are at the cap or beyond based on things beyond their control?
Well, the last time I looked, there was a big gap between the small banks and the big banks. In other words, there's a handful of banks that would be subject to being broken up. And then there's a big, like we're talking $100 billion gap between the smallest of the largest banks and the largest of the medium-sized banks. So there's a place where you could put that threshold in, at least there was in 2008, 2009, where you would capture the riskiest, largest banks and leave everybody else alone.
What are some of the, as we call them, toxic lending practices that Dodd-Frank tries to get at and that we should be looking for here, that if we're concerned about what financial reform could do, what are some things in terms of lending practices that might be red flags if we see them starting again?
Well, the number one is the so-called subprime home mortgage loan, where during the run-up to the financial crisis, everybody remembers that potential home buyers who with no verifiable income, no assets, and poor credit ratings were getting fairly large mortgages. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has really reined in those kind of lending practices. So if the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rolls back its enforcement regulation, those type of loans could creep back in. And this happens when the housing market accelerates and there's a boom and more people want to enter the market and you start to move to extend credit to more risky borrowers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau tries to make sure that that type of practice doesn't happen. But that extends, there's subprime auto loans that people are concerned about right now. Student loan disclosures about the risks of burdening of too much student loan has been a focus of the CFPB, and even commercial lending and know your customer rules. If commercial lending gets to places where loans to business start to go south, that can be a problem for banks. So the consumer protection is one thing, know your customer rules, and then it's really capital and other requirements that prevent the commercial loans from seeping into the broader financial market.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been one of those areas of criticism from people who want to scale back financial reform, saying that it's been too heavy-handed, that it's put lenders in a bad spot in several situations. How has it generally worked over these last several years since it was enacted?
From the compliance officers that I've talked to in the U.S., it was a major shock transition to the new rules and the new paperwork and the new requirements. And there was a lot of complaints when they first started scrutinizing home loans about the inability of banks to make new mortgages. But given the volume of mortgage lending and the recovery of the housing market, that transition probably has been successful. But the CFPB is a target for those who want to reform. Right now, it's not subject to the congressional appropriations process. It gets a percentage of the Federal Reserve System's budget, and there's a director, single director, with an appointment that staggers so it doesn't coincide with the president's term. That governance structure is probably going to go out the door, where the agency is going to report to Congress, and there may even be a commission instead of a director that would permit Trump to appoint a number of commissioners that could then roll back regulation and make it a little less assertive.
You've mentioned a couple of times that we seem to see lending going back up to the levels we'd expect it to be at. Now, President Trump has been saying that there are businesses that can't get loans, et cetera, and there are some people looking at the data and seeing that it doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, based on what we see about lending, is it roughly where we would expect it to be given economic conditions, et cetera, or is there reason to believe that the regulations have in some way prevented lending from being where it could be at otherwise?
Well, the volume of home mortgage securitization through Freddie Mac, the big housing government-sponsored enterprise, is huge. I mean, so the mortgage market is thriving in that sense. And the only data that I've seen, bank loans to commercial and industrial borrowers, those have grown back to pre-crisis levels. So if you just look at those kind of two indicators, the health of the mortgage market and the availability of capital to commercial and industrial borrowers, they both are consistent with high levels of lending.
Is any financial reform basically trying to find the right spot, the right balance between regulations that prevent the excesses of 2007 and 8, but also allowing for, I guess, some acceptable risk that you have to have if you're going to have a free market economy and economic growth?
Yeah, that's absolutely the trade-off. You want banks to be profitable. You want banks to take risks. You want people to be able to get credit. But what you don't want to happen is when the extension of credit goes south and the financial institution starts to fail and other financial institutions are disrupted, that taxpayers are on the hook for a bailout. So you try to address all three components of that. You try to make sure that loans that cannot be repaid are not given in the first place. You try to make sure that individual financial institutions, if they fail, their failure doesn't cascade onto others. And you try to make sure if it does cascade onto others, they're resolved and they don't come for a taxpayer-funded bailout. So that's why Dodd-Frank gets at all three of those things. All three have to go wrong. You have to have toxic loans. You have to have financial institutions without enough capital that are connected to other financial institutions that are too big to fail in order to get the kind of crisis we saw.
Now, you do a lot of study and research on financial institutions, financial regulation, but of course, you're also a political science professor. How does financial reform play as a political issue? Does it play as a political issue? You know, are there ways of trying to make the case on one side or the other that seem to strike a chord with voters?
Well, my experience with this has been when Wall Street is the villain, everybody is on board for financial regulation. And there was a very brief window, 2008, 2009, where Wall Street was the villain. Bankers were bad. We needed to bring them to heel.
And Dodd-Frank got passed.
This is a repeat of what happened in the 1930s, right? In the 1930s, bankers were the villains. Reforms got passed. The difference in the 30s, the bankers were villains for 10 to 12 years. And there was an ongoing long-term process of cranking down risk in the financial system and making it safer. That's when we got the FDIC. That's when we got the SEC. Today, bankers don't seem to be the villains. Wall Street's in the White House. There's no appetite for aggressive financial reform. So it takes a financial crisis, apparently, to bring that to people's attention. We had a financial crisis. We got reform. As the memory of the crisis recedes, people are more willing to let regulatory reform kind of roll back. So I hope it's not a cycle that I see repeated many times over the course of the next 30 years of a crisis and reform, roll back and reform another crisis. But that does seem to be what we're looking at going forward.
You said Wall Street and the White House, referring, of course, to President Trump and many of the people whom he's put in his cabinet. And actually, President Trump, in many ways, kind of made his money more in real estate than the necessary.
Right. When I said Wall Street and the White House, I was referring to the director of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, the former Goldman Sachs executive, and the Secretary of the Treasury, another Wall Street actor who's going to be largely in charge of overseeing how Dodd-Frank and other related rules are actually reformed.
But we certainly have a Republican administration, a Republican Congress. Generally, the Republicans have been more on the side of less regulation. So if you are someone who wants to see these regulations rolled back, is there a better scenario for you right now than what you have in Washington?
No. You've got the prime player who's been kind of empowered by all this is Jeb Hensarling, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. He's been an advocate of some sensible regulatory reforms and some more ambitious regulatory reforms that people view as a mistake. But he's got a lot of power, and he's got a direct connection to Trump and the Trump White House. And the Senate will be the roadblock, and will be the roadblock for these efforts to dismantle Dodd-Frank. But the Republican House has a laundry list of things that they want to change, and we're going to see those coming forward after this regulatory review that the Trump administration has asked for, this 120-day review process that we're now 30 days into.
You say that the Senate could be the roadblock, but that is also controlled by the Republicans.
Right. It's just that it's the combination of the filibuster plus the long memory of some Republican senators about what happened with the bailout and the financial crisis might temper some of the regulatory reforms that come out of the House.
Kevin Corder, thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Kevin Corder is a political science professor at Western Michigan University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.